None surpass penetrating and perfect Dharma, is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Morning, everybody. So I start by thanking Tim and Chris for their talks the last couple of days. It was a pleasure to listen to Dharma talks instead of giving them. And you can imagine how nice it is for me in particular to hear the Dharma expressed in their voices. And I'm really glad that Chris brought up the pandemic and what a real catastrophe it has been and continues to be. It's one of the most amazing capacities of human beings, which is both good and horrifying at the same time, that we get used to things that are really terrible and we sort of just take them for granted after a while. So I'm glad that Chris reminded us of what has been going on. And I also appreciated Chris for so perfectly evoking the feeling of being at Samish, which probably a lot of you, most of you, know what it's like to be at Samish. And she did a great job of, you know, with the swallows and the sunsets and all that. She really evoked the feeling. And I wasn't missing it at all until she brought it up. And then I started missing it. So the last time I was talking to you, I spoke about breathing, or rather, I mostly, Mel spoke about breathing, not me. And breathing is such an important practice for me. I love being with my breathing. But I realized that there are some people for whom breathing is not a happy experience, right? People have asthma. One of our Sangha members has a real bad case of, I think it's called COPD, which is breathing trouble. He needs to have oxygen. So breathing for a lot of people is not, you know, pleasant and calm. It can be anxiety producing. People have, you know, lung cancer, all kinds of troubles with their lungs. And I also realize that there's lots of ways of practicing that don't involve any connection to the breathing at all. You know, practicing loving kindness meditation or different phrases meditations, all kinds of meditations that don't involve the breathing. So if you have some other way to practice that is good for you and that you're used to and that you are here to continue to practice, please keep doing that. I'm not trying to tell everybody that they should practice with the breathing. Of course, if you want to do that, it's really good. I recommend it. So do it. You know, even if you have another practice you want to try it, do it, but you don't have to do it. And so today I want to talk a little more about the breath, and maybe it is relevant directly for your practice, and maybe not. But even if it's not, maybe if you listen carefully enough, you will hear in what I'm saying about the breath, the deeper pattern or the shape behind what I'm saying And you can see how it also applies to whatever practice you're doing. And even if that's not true for you, I hope my talk will be a relief from your own mind, which I guess is otherwise chattering on and off with the usual stuff, you know, that your mind has always been chattering about. So maybe if you listen to me, you can take a little break from your own craziness and hear something else, you know, some other craziness, which is maybe different. So possibly you remember that when I was quoting at length from Mel, his talk on breathing, he mentioned in there the sutra on the full awareness of breathing. And he said, referring to the 16 methods of practice with the breath that are mentioned in that sutra, and this is now Mel's words, the last method of practicing with the breath in order is the last method is practicing with the breath in order to understand impermanence, in order to realize impermanence, and to practice letting go of body and mind so that the whole life is lived consciously and our entire death is lived consciously in the same manner. That's what he said. And he was referring directly to the sutra on the full awareness of breathing, in the last of its 16 different methods. So in Dharma practice, impermanence is a very profound point. Nobody denies impermanence. You can't really get around it. Everybody, I think, realizes, yes, things are impermanent. And everyone kind of understands impermanence as sort of like here today, gone tomorrow. So it's not that big a problem. Just tomorrow isn't here yet. So in the meantime, you know, it's not that big a problem. And it seems like be here now, which is how most people understand what Zen is about, is kind of like the opposite of impermanence, right? You know, why worry about impermanence, which is later? Be here now and don't worry about it. Sort of makes sense, right? But actually, in Dharma practice, impermanence is much more than this. Impermanence is non-self, non-abiding. Actually, there isn't anything here today that will be gone tomorrow. We are fundamentally confused about what is here today, and that's our problem. Impermanence is also interconnection, interdependence, or as Suzuki Roshi sometimes calls it, independency. We are love, we are compassion. We're fully, always, and ever connected to everything. And at the same time, and I think this is where Suzuki Roshi's word, independency, comes into it. We are all completely alone in all the universe. And what that means is that we are completely met, embraced, and created all the time by all the universe, which we are. And the universe is empty of the universe, and we are empty of ourselves. So that what we think we are and what we're clinging to, which gives us so much pain, doesn't actually exist in the way we think it does. And that's what is in Buddha Dharma, impermanence means. It means all that. We could even say, I think, with justice, that in all of Buddha Dharma, there's only one teaching, the teaching of impermanence, and all the other teachings are just different ways of helping us to turn the jewel of impermanence and view it from different angles. Anyway, when I read those lines from Mel, it made me want to go and study again the sutra on the full awareness of breathing. So I did that. And Thich Nhat Hanh wrote a little book about it some years ago called Breathe, You Are Alive, Sutra on the Full Awareness of Breathing. So I studied that book, and this morning I want to share some of what I learned from it. The book was a little bit controversial when it came out some years ago, because in it, in his very gentle way, Thich Nhat Hanh appears so gentle, you know, but he's actually quite tough. in this book, he denies the importance of the classical deep meditation states, you know, the eight jhanic states, four form jhanas and the four formless jhanas. He denies that these are important, or that even they're an essential part of Buddhism at all. And when he said this, you know, this upset a lot of people. But Thich Nhat Hanh is a great Buddhist teacher of our age, and he's also quite reliable and knowledgeable of the tradition. And so he has a lot of good reasons for this point of view. And basically, he's saying that these deep meditation practices were exactly the pre-existing meditation practices in Indian culture that the Buddha practiced before his awakening and rejected as he went off to find his own way. He rejected them because, although they were powerful, they were not conducive to the liberation that he sought. And so Thich Nhat Hanh believes that these practices were then added later on to the Buddhist canon by enthusiastic meditators who wanted to practice them anyway. And he points out that they are not mentioned at all in the Sutra on the Full Awareness of Breathing. So he's saying, in effect, you know, these deep meditation practices are good recreation for meditation specialists. Maybe they're more entertaining than Netflix and everything. But they are possibly unnecessary and even perhaps counterproductive for the liberation that we really need for our human life, which is what the Buddha was concerned with. Anyway, the sutra on the full awareness of breathing is pretty short. It's only about, 10 short pages in big type in Thich Nhat Hanh's little book. And I'll just read for you the few pages that describe in detail the 16 methods for breathing practice. It's like this, bhikkhus. The practitioner goes into the forest or to the foot of a tree or to any deserted place and sits stably in the lotus position, holding his body quite straight. Breathing in, he knows that he's breathing in, and breathing out, he knows that he's breathing out. Number one, breathing in a long breath, she knows I'm breathing in a long breath. Breathing out a long breath, she knows I'm breathing out a long breath. Two, breathing in a short breath, she knows I'm breathing in a short breath. Breathing out a long breath, she knows, sorry, breathing out a short breath, she knows I'm breathing out a short breath. Three, I'm breathing in and I'm aware of my whole body. I'm breathing out and I'm aware of my whole body. This is how she practices. Four, I'm breathing in and making my whole body calm and at peace. I'm breathing out and making my whole body calm and at peace. This is how he practices. Five, I'm breathing in and feeling joyful. Breathing out and feeling joyful. This is how he deep practices. Six, I'm breathing in and feeling happy. I'm breathing out and feeling happy. He practices like this. Seven, I'm breathing in and I'm aware of the activities of the mind in me. I'm breathing out and I'm aware of the activities of the mind in me. She practices like this. Eight, I'm breathing in and making the activities of the mind in me calm and at peace. I'm breathing out and making the activities of the mind in me calm and at peace. She practices like this. Nine, I'm breathing in and am aware of my mind. I'm breathing out and am aware of my mind. She practices like this. 10. I'm breathing in and making my mind happy and at peace. I'm breathing out and making my mind happy and at peace. She practices like this. 11. I'm breathing in and concentrating my mind. I'm breathing out and concentrating my mind. She practices like this. 12. I'm breathing in and liberating my mind. I'm breathing out and liberating my mind. He practices like this. 13. I'm breathing in and observing the impermanent nature of all dharmas. And from here on, this is the part Mel was talking about. 13, I'm breathing in and observing the impermanence nature of all dharmas. I am breathing out and observing the impermanent nature of all dharmas. He practices like this. 14, I'm breathing in and observing the fading of all dharmas. I'm breathing out and observing the fading of all dharmas. She practices like this. 15, I'm breathing in and observing liberation. I'm breathing out and observing liberation. She practices like this. 16, I am breathing in and observing letting go. I'm breathing out and observing letting go. She practices like this. The full awareness of breathing, if developed and practiced continuously according to these instructions, will be rewarding and of great benefit. So that's the exact wording of these 16 clear steps of meditation practice. But if we really think about what this really amounts to, I think we can see it's a little more streamlined and simple maybe than this sort of outline of 16 steps. And the main point, of course, is that we focus our attention on the breathing in detail. So you're being with the breath, and when it mentions long and short breath, it's not telling you that you should breathe a long breath and then you should breathe a short breath. It's telling you simply that you're aware of the whole breath in detail. You know if it's long or short or coarse or subtle or labored or easy. You know it because you're aware of the whole thing. You're paying very close attention to breath and you see the whole breath, all of it. It comes into view. And when the breath comes into view, you're going to feel the whole body. You're going to be aware of the whole body because breathing isn't like a separate thing from the body. It doesn't just take place, you know, in the lungs. Literally, the whole body is breathing because the breathing is the blood, and the blood is moving in the body everywhere. Every single tiny place in the body is being affected by every breath in a very concrete, literal, physiological way. So when you're aware of the breathing, you're going to be aware of the whole body. And you're going to be sitting there paying attention to the breathing and to the whole body. And when you do that, when you're paying attention to the breathing and the whole body, I don't know why, but there's a feeling of calmness that will come. Somehow or other, the whole body becomes still. The heart, the mind, becomes still. There's calmness when you are aware of body and breathing. So if you're not calm, you're not aware of the body and the breathing. And when you become aware of the body of the and the breathing, you will become calm. And sometimes the conditions of mind that make you not calm are so strong that you are not able to become aware of the breathing in the body. That does happen sometimes. But it just means, when I'm agitated in this way, I'm not aware of the breathing in the body. And so that's why if we establish a habit and a relationship with the breathing, then in times when we are not calm, it really will help us to breathe and be aware of the body. And even if we can't do that perfectly and the mind is suddenly perfectly peaceful, we can definitely be more peaceful if we pay attention to the breathing. I've observed this in my own experience many, many times in, difficult situations. So these are the first steps as described. And then it says in the text, there's a feeling of peacefulness and joy. And then the next step is there's happiness. And so it makes it sound like you're going to make that happen, but I don't think it means you make that happen. It means this is what happens when you develop awareness of the breathing and the body, and there's some calmness, you feel some joy and some happiness. And I think that's why we like to go to Sesshin. I mean, if you describe Sesshin to somebody and say you're going to spend a week doing this, they might think, what's wrong with you? Like, who could imagine anything less edifying than that? It's so repetitive, you're not doing anything much. Why not go swimming in Hawaii or climb a mountain or something, more interesting? But as we know, there's so much joy and happiness in Sesshin, not necessarily every single minute, but you feel a kind of joy and happiness in Sesshin that you wouldn't feel in other situations that might seem more pleasant. So you're aware of the whole body. And I think that doesn't mean that you're not aware of specific details of the body. In fact, you are also, you're aware of the whole experience of the body, but if you have a pain over here or some sensation over there, you notice that too in detail. But also in Zazen, when we emphasize posture, that's what it's about. Because there may be parts of the body that hold our suffering, so we know how to open up that part of the body. And in my own case, I often pay attention, especially to the upper part of my spine, because I think that a lot of us, and we're unconsciously kind of slightly bent over, especially as we get older. It's just sort of what happens to us. So if in sitting, to the best of your ability, you emphasize lifting the sternum and lifting and opening, being conscious in the upper part of your spine, it actually literally opens up the heart area. So I'm always paying attention to that in my sitting. And when my upper body lifts and opens, I feel like I'm sitting right in the center point of the universe, receiving the whole universe. And then I also pay attention to my mudra, that it's soft and that my thumb tips are just touching and that my mudra is touching my belly right where my breathing is coming in and out. And the whole thing could be quite fussy, but I don't fuss about it. It's automatic, right? And there may be some adjustment that automatically occurs quite naturally and normally as I'm sitting and breathing. It's almost like my breath is adjusting my mudra without my trying to do it. Anyway, with this sitting comes, as it says in these next steps, joy and happiness. You might say, what's the difference between joy and happiness? Well, in his commentary, Thich Nhat Hanh mentions a traditional metaphor for this, where the difference between joy and happiness is the difference between being in the desert and seeing ahead of you an oasis, and then arriving at the oasis and drinking. So seeing the oasis ahead is joy. You know, there's some excitement and anticipation. So in that sense, it's a little bit destabilizing. There's something a little too exciting about joy, although it's a wonderful feeling. But then when you get to the oasis and you drink, then you're just experiencing the refreshment of drinking. And it's very down to earth. And that's happiness. And so that's the kind of happiness that we can enjoy from time to time in Sesshin. The feeling that, you know, I don't need anything else. It's just a joy to breathe and feel the body. That is enough. That's happiness, right? Happiness is, this is perfectly enough and perfectly sufficient to be alive in the body and in the breath. So that's roughly the first six of the 16 steps. And next comes, I am breathing in and out, and I'm aware of the activities of mind in me. So up to now, it's been really only about the body. So now I am aware of the activities of mind in me. And again, I don't think this is something that we are trying to do. It's something that happens after we settle and calm ourselves. It may be that something is supposed to come to mind, and it does. So the effort we're making intentionally is to be with the breathing and the body, but then something that is supposed to be there in that moment arises in the mind. And then we have the stability then to simply be aware of that which arises in the mind. So stuff always comes into the mind because we're living beings in a world, and the mind is, and the world are always in a different state. So there could be a thought, a sensation in the body, there could be a memory, there could be a sound. All of these things are activities of the mind or objects of mind. So in Buddhist thought, it's a really important notion. One of the Buddha's very simple but crucial insights, that there's no such thing as consciousness per se. Some consciousness that is independent and floating around in the sky. And this is another way to understand what the Buddha meant by interconnection or emptiness. The fact that there is no such thing as a consciousness apart from an object of that consciousness. Where there is an object of consciousness, there's consciousness, and where there's consciousness, there's an object of consciousness. Consciousness and object in that sense are empty because they completely depend on one another, and you can't say that there's one of them without the other. And it's the same as non-self. If there were independent consciousness, then we could say there's a self, that consciousness. But if there's no independent consciousness, there's no self other than the meeting in a moment of consciousness and object. The meeting and the falling away, moment after moment, of object and consciousness, which we call existence. Not only life, but existence. So this is a very deep insight that the Buddha had, and it's really important for us to appreciate it. So in the practice, you establish strong focus on breath and body, and you will feel the calmness and the joy and the happiness that will arise. And then you will become aware of the objects of consciousness as they arise. Here is this thought, comes and goes. Here is this sound, it comes and goes. Now, we're aware all the time to some degree or another. You know, we might be aware, we're not sitting zazen, but we're aware we're thinking this or feeling that and so on. And it seems that we are aware of it, but actually we're not aware of it in the sense meant here. Because as soon as we grab hold of the thought and make something of it and start, you know, perseverating about it and, you know, feeling good about it, feeling bad about it, so on and so on and so on, believing it's our thought, believing it's important, believing it's painful, and so on and so on. As soon as we start doing all of that, we're agitated and disturbed and caught up in the thought, identified with the thought as real, permanent in some way, even though we don't call it permanent, and our own. And as soon as that is happening, we're not really aware of the nature of the thought itself or whatever it is, because we've already elaborated it, covered it over with a veneer of our clinging. And therefore, we're not really aware of the thought. We're aware of the covering, you know, mostly, and we think we're aware of the thought. So in Zazen, once we've established this powerful focus, you know, and the breathing and the body, and there's some ease and joy and calmness to whatever extent that we can have it, we can then actually be aware of whatever object of mind arises in the true sense. And this is, I think, what Dogen meant in that line in Fukan Zazengi that Tim brought up the other day, the line about think, not thinking, what's not thinking, non-thinking. And I appreciate it very much. I think that was great that he went into the details of the language and how those words parse out in Japanese, because, I mean, it showed us that it's the same in Japanese, more or less, in English. That's what I got out of what he was telling us. And that helps. So non-thinking, as Dogen says, is not thinking in the usual sense, not thinking with that veneer of clinging, covering the thinking. Non-thinking is when we are truly aware of thinking and we understand what it is and we let it fully come and go and we completely appreciate it. In other words, it's non-thinking because it's a kind of thinking, but it's not at all the usual kind of thinking. The difference may be subtle, but it makes all the difference. And this is one of the most important things we learn from Zazen without knowing we're learning it. We learn how to think not thinking, think non-thinking. It's one of the most, as I say, valuable things we learn, how to let thoughts come and go without being destabilized by them, captured by them. And this is the seventh step in the 16-step practice, becoming aware of the activities of mind as we breathe in and out. And then just the same as in the earlier practices, you notice the pattern is the same. Once we have a smooth awareness, we can become calm even as something is in the mind. It doesn't make any difference whether something's in the mind or not. And even if you have a disturbing thought or a very unpleasant sensation or memory, like, you know, a pain in your body, you can still be quite calm when you're just aware of it. And all the while, the breath is fully supporting you. So now you're sitting with a great harmony. And Mel spoke, I think it was Tim who brought up Mel's idea of balancing with gravity and spirit, I think, was Tim saying this. This is the balancing part. You're balancing body, breath, and mind. And usually we're overbalanced in the direction of mind, which is also emotion. When you're sitting, you build up a habit in a way of holding body, breath, and mind in harmony. And so they're all present, but they balance one another so that not one of them doesn't get out of whack. And when in sitting, one of them does go out of whack, you know how right away to bring yourself back to balance in the sitting. So next comes the next step after objects of mind is mind. So a minute ago, we talked about mind and objects of mind and how they can't be separate from one another. So what's the difference exactly between mind and object of mind? Well, there isn't, in a way, any difference between a thought and the mind that thinks this thought. We can't like figure out how to tease these two things apart, really. But here, when we're becoming aware of mind as opposed to objects of mind, we're now beginning, as we just continue practicing, minding our own business, so to speak, we begin to notice how it is that mind and object of mind are not really separate things. In other words, you realize this is not my thought, my sensation, my sound that I'm hearing, my feeling that I'm feeling, my memory that I'm remembering. You see, you just experience it as mind itself coming and going in the objects of mind coming and going, which you can fully allow them to come and go. So you realize, you know, and again, this is not like a cognitive, oh, I get this point. No, you just experience it directly as this thought is not inside my mind. This sound is not outside my mind. And you realize the inaccuracy of the idea of inside and outside. This object, that object. It's just mind coming and going. Of course, as soon as you're sitting there and you say, ah, look at that. It's just mind coming and going. Right? Now, it's an object of mind. It's not mind anymore. You've made it into a thought and an insight that now you have the satisfaction of having possessed. And maybe I'm even a little clinging to the thought that, gee, what a good meditator. I finally got the Zen goodies that I was hoping for and so on. And then you're no longer in that moment, you know, appreciating mind itself, which is just a feeling, a sense that we have about our life, which, as we learned from Tim also the other day, and this is my favorite line in Tim's talk, when he said, how absurd a conception this is, my life. He said, there's me and my life. I thought that was really great. My life, you know, what in the world would that be, my life? I think about that all the time, you know, like whose life? What life? Really? What is this that we're talking about? Anyway, I think you get this. So anyway, we're aware of our breathing. And now the breathing isn't just breathing anymore, right? It's not just physiology. It has become by now, you know, a sense of life, a sense of time and space, a sense of being situated in life without anything extra necessary. So then there's naturally a simple sense of calm, peace, happiness. And one realizes that most of the time I'm just foolishly wrapped up in stuff that I don't really need to be so worried about. You know, what am I worried about? And then the 11th step unfolds, which is concentration. So yes, Thich Nhat Hanh agrees, and I think it's clear in Buddha Dharma that we do need a degree of concentration and powerful meditative stability if we're really going to liberate ourselves from our attachment to our pain. So the mind is concentrated, and concentration just means unified. A mind that's not scattered, that is stopped here, and in being stopped goes beyond itself. And whatever, however you're practicing, you know, whether it's the breathing or some other way, there's a strong sense of presence beyond whatever the object is. And maybe it lasts just for a microsecond. It's not a matter of, you know, extending it at all. It's just a matter of it arises and it passes away like everything else, and maybe it arises again or not. Anyway, in order to appreciate the last steps, which involve awareness of impermanence, you need to have a concentrated mind. Otherwise, impermanence will always be a concept, an idea, an emotional feeling, you know, a sense of nostalgia, but not the awareness of impermanence that will really free you. So this is the last part that Mill mentioned, seeing impermanence. All of this now enables us to really see impermanence. And you see it. And again, I'm saying this like as if this was a reasonable thing to say, but it's not something that you say or, you know, experience cognitively. You just feel it in your body, how everything is arising and passing away at the same time, as if, is anything really here at all? You know, we live and die, but did anything happen? You feel it like that. It's a kind of a beautiful feeling. I mean, it's very right there in the breath, right? Because the breath does that. The breath comes and goes, and the closer you are to the breath, the more it's clear there's nothing to it. There's no static piece of a breath that you could ever hold on to. That's the truth about the breath and everything else. And that's why our life experience of trying to hold on to stuff is inevitably always painful. Even when it looks like we're holding on to stuff, we never really are. And we're sitting and we can feel body, breath, mind, world fading away on every moment, coming back and fading away as one experience without divisions, coming and going at the same time. So impermanence might as well be called permanence, because there's nothing to be impermanent. It's so precious, so fleeting, and so, in a way, eternal, that it's easy and natural to let go. And the secret, you know, sometimes I think that the practice is like just a big joke, you know, because the secret of it is that there's nothing to be liberated, and there was nothing that never was not liberated. So what's liberation? And letting go is also nothing, because there never was anything that anybody was ever holding on to anyway. So we think of letting go as this big, scary thing. Oh my God, I got all this stuff and I have to let go of it. Yeah, I don't know about that. But you never had this stuff. It was just an illusion, a big joke anyway. So there is nothing to let go of. There's no letting go. So the whole thing is kind of funny in a way. I mean, this thing that we cherish, that is the most important thing of all, more important than anything and everything, because it includes anything and everything, including love, there's nothing to it. And all the words in all the sutras are like things that people scratch in the sand at the beach, you know, and then the water comes in and it's all gone and somebody scratches something else. So in the sutra on the full awareness of breathing, there is no eight jhanas. There's also, as you might have noticed, no practice of counting the breath, as I mentioned the other day. The practice of counting the breath is not in the original meditation on breathing. I think most people do agree that this sutra on the full awareness of breathing is an earlier text than later texts about meditation. So later on, after meditators practiced with the sutra for centuries, I think they understood that maybe it's a little bit difficult to hold on to this process as written. So somebody or other figured out that it would be a good idea to count the breaths. That might help. If you have trouble, you know, understanding and staying with the various steps, you could just simplify the whole thing by counting the breaths. But there is counting and there's counting. So counting can be a really good beginning practice to come back to anytime your mind is coarse and disturbed, which could happen anytime during meditation practice, you know, during session, you might find your mind is rough. And that's when it's good to come back to counting for stabilizing you as an anchor for your mind. And then you might find that once your mind does become more subtle and calm, then the counting seems a little bit conceptual and clunky and extra and bothersome, so you don't feel like doing it anymore and you can let it go. So that can be one kind of counting, but also counting can be a very, very deep concentration and insight practice. It can take you all the way to impermanence, counting the breath at a deeper level in which the numbers are both there and not there. And it's as if the whole universe is turning on each number. So the rest of the sutra talks about how these 16 steps of breathing practice are mapped onto the four foundations of mindfulness, which maybe you could hear in the steps. The four foundations: mindfulness of the body, of feelings, of mind, and objects of mind. All of that unfolds in the practice of breathing. The sutra also mentions the seven factors of enlightenment, which are also arising naturally when you practice breathing. So as I tell all this, you know, it all sounds maybe good and quite organized, but, you know, life is never that organized and reasonable, rational. In a way, the sutras are inevitably going to always be crude when they describe step-by-step processes. Because in practice, the closer you get to your mind and to your breath, the more one thing becomes another. And you always have to jump off the instructions into space Any instructions are just kind of to get you going. Once you get going, you jump off. Breathing practice is not really a program, and it is very simple. Pay attention to breath and body. Don't observe breath and body, but just disappear completely into them. So there's no observer and no object to be observed. Don't be too tight when you sit. Let yourself relax. Don't make too much effort. Just enough. But trust the wisdom of the body. You know, I always say, you know, you might be scared to die, but when it's time to die, your body will know exactly what to do. Body is so smart, you know, it'll do it. Even though you say, no, I'm not going to die. Body says, shut up, you know, let me take over now, and it will. Your body knows what to do, always. So trust your body, which means trust your practice. And the rest will just unfold. And if it does not seem to be working at all, this happens, right? Something happens, you know, sometimes it looks like nothing happened, but usually something happens in your life. And then, oh my God, my practice is not working at all. I'm just such a wreck. Trust the wreck that you are and keep going. Trust that wherever you are, however a mess it may seem, that is the next step that must be taken in this unfolding of the truth that you jokingly refer to as your life, but we all know better. So I think one of the problems we have in our practice is that we want our cake and we want to eat it too, right? Like the old saying goes. We want to be liberated and happy, and we want the satisfaction of watching how it is that we just did that. Right? Not enough that we would be liberated and happy. We want the satisfaction of knowing I just did that. So we can pat ourselves on the back and more importantly, know for sure that we're certified as having done such a thing, just like the sutra tells us. But I think it's better to just be liberated and happy and not even know that that happened to you, not even notice it. Just appreciate it and just live it. And notice as you look around that everyone is also liberated and happy, no matter how miserable they appear to be. We're all sharing this awakening together all the time. It's the only thing happening. And you notice that. It's very beautiful. We are human beings together with all that that entails from top to bottom. So, what a beautiful session. Let's all keep it up. Thank you all for being here and for your devotion to practice and for all that each one of you I know is doing for other people in your life. Your practice is helping them a lot. So when they complain that you're taking the time off and they're having to do the dishes this week, tell them, no, I'm doing it for you, really. I am. Okay. Thanks. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Karma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's his ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.